histories on successful candidates for the presidency. Maybe there's a good deal to be learned also from those who didn't make it. Some of us who sometimes haven't made it think that's true in our own walk of life, and maybe it's also true in politics. This might be particularly the case in the instance of Adlai Stevenson. He had a unique following. I remember once coming back very late at night and seeing a room full of people listening to his acceptance speech for the nomination, I think at four in the morning. And they certainly were a unique constituency with their devotion and following. Sometimes defeated candidates are prophetic. Stevenson was in some areas, at least. Sometimes they're a vanishing breed, as Stevenson was in writing his own speeches. And so for that and many other reasons, we thought it was important. Also, the Miller Center has been interested in particular problems, such as the selection problem process of presidents and vice presidents. And Porter McKeever and Adlai Stevenson have some experience to share on that topic. Porter began his career as a Washington newspaper and radio correspondent. He was director of the OWI in Reykjavik, Iceland during World War II, and then chief of American psychological warfare operations in North Burma, eventually in World War II, chief in the headquarters of American psychological warfare operations in the Southeast Asia Command. He was press relations officer of the Department of State, press officer of the U.S. delegation to the U.N., and director of information of the U.S. mission to the U.N. He was executive director of the Chicago Council on Foreign Relations. He was director of public reports for the Ford Foundation and director of information director of information for the CED, Committee for Economic Development. He was president of the United Nations Association for the United States and vice president of the John D. Rockefeller III Fund and consultant to the Rockefeller Family Associates. He assisted Secretary Burns in writing Speaking Frankly, and most recently has written a widely reviewed and discussed biography and analysis of Adlai Stevenson. We're very pleased that he could stop off be with us in Virginia as he moves around the country to talk about the Adlai Stevenson book. It's a great pleasure to welcome you, Porter.
Thank you, Ken. You know, on a lovely day like this in Virginia, it's hard to summon up a vision of a cold, wintry morning in Illinois, but this welcome and your being here remind me of a story that Adlai used to like to tell about the milk cow on a farm in Illinois in a winter morning, who turned to the farmer and said, "Thank you for that warm hand." "Thank you for this warm welcome." One of the expressions of appreciation that Adlai most often liked to tell was about arriving at a political rally one time and marching up and down in front of the rostrum was a very pregnant lady carrying a placard saying, "Adlai's the man." In his notebooks, I also found another story that helps explain one of the reasons why I'm so glad to be here today. But you know, actually, Susan and I couldn't resist coming down to Charlottesville at this time of the year. We wanted, for one thing, to show Jefferson's Country to our young visitor from Spain over here, who has just received her law degree from the University of Heidelberg. Also, you know, the relevance of Adlai to contemporary issues is so lively that I really welcome every chance I get to share his insights. And as I mentioned in his notebooks, I found a story that he sometimes used that places my eagerness to talk about him alongside the eagerness of another politician, Al Smith, to talk whenever he had a chance. And on this occasion, he found himself facing an audience of convicts at Sing Sing. And he began with his usual opening salutation, "My fellow citizens." Then he realized that convicts weren't citizens, so he stopped and he said, "Oh, my fellow convicts." Then he realized that wasn't quite appropriate, so after a pause he said, "Well, in any event, I'm glad to see so many of you here." this wonderful university certainly is not a prison, especially after exam time. It's more freedom and escape are tend to be in the air. But I really am glad to see so many of you here on a lovely morning like this. In addition to borrowing Adlai's stories, there's another way I'd like to follow in his footsteps. He spoke here twice. On November 11th, 55, he was here as the principal speaker at the opening of the Woodrow Wilson Centennial, and he returned again on April 12th, 1960, to give the Founders' Day address. Both those speeches still make very rewarding reading. But I'm taking my theme today from his 1960 speech that he built around this quote from Jefferson. "Cherish, therefore, the spirit of our people, and keep alive their attention. Once they become inattentive to public affairs, you and I and Congress and judges and governors shall all become wolves." Now place Jefferson's warning beside a report issued earlier this month under the leadership of the president of this university. American voters today, President O'Neill's panel stated, do not seem to understand their rightful place in the operation of democracy. They act as if they believe that the presidential elections belong to somebody else, most notably the candidates and their handlers. And that certainly is the way we acted in 1988. Barely half of those eligible to vote bothered to register a choice for the presidency of the United States. We may not yet be wolves, but Jefferson's very stark imagery is really reflected in a recent poll that showed 70% of adult Americans believe that our Congress is devoid of integrity. What's worse, one in every four believed at least half of all senators and congressmen are financially corrupt. You don't need polls, really, to be aware of the cynicism that has seeped into and is corroding our entire political process. And this is happening at a time when democratic ideals and institutions have before them the most far-flung opportunity since humanity began its struggle toward freedom. You know, it's really a supreme irony that the fervor for democratic ideals and processes seems to be far more vibrant and alive in Eastern Europe today, and far more dramatically affirmed in Tiananmen Square than here in democracy's homeland. And another irony is this defeated candidate warned us of developments that today are the sources of much of our alienation and our cynicism. Let me focus today, though, on our national leadership, because I think most of us in 1988 longed for the opportunity to choose between an Eisenhower and a Stevenson, as contrasted with a Bush and a Dukakis. But more important than our personal longings is the fact that the quality of our leadership now has such fateful consequences for this entire planet. And the present charade in Congress on election reform might stir hope in some of us, but to me it's more suggestive of a comment Stevenson made in another context about the fan in relation to the fan dancer. There's no real intent to cover the subject. It's only to call attention to it and to fool us into thinking that there's really going to be some action. But there's more than temporary titillation, this idea going, that grow out of Adlai's observations and experiences. The intervening decades have demonstrated how right he was in concentrating not on campaign spending, but on campaign costs, and on the state-by-state primary system, on the misuse of television, and not so incidentally, on the way we choose the one who's only a heartbeat away from the highest office in our land. For this latter issue, he didn't quail, and the pun is fully intended. In 56, he told the Democratic National Convention, "The American people have a solemn obligation to consider with utmost care who will be their president if the elected president is prevented by a higher will from serving his full term." That statement was made long before a major news magazine carried the picture of our vice president with the caption, "No joke." He pointed out to the delegates in 56, "It is a sober reminder that 7 out of 34 presidents have served as a result of such indirect selection. The choice for that office has become almost as important as the choice for the presidency." And he then announced that the convention itself should choose the vice presidential nominee without any preference or pressure from him. He arrived at that position over the vigorous, even the angry opposition of Speaker, such powerful figures as Speaker Rayburn, Majority Leader Lyndon Johnson, the chairman of the Democratic Party, and most of his own closest supporters. But his abhorrence, and that's not too strong a word, his abhorrence of Richard Nixon, combined with the casual ambivalence with which the illness-stricken President Eisenhower had kept Nixon on the ticket, made Stevenson very stubbornly resolved to an action that he hoped at the time would become an established practice. Of course, it hasn't. Now, there was a measure of opportunism in that stand. The president's health and age had made succession an important but largely unspoken issue. But deep conviction also was at the heart of that proposal, and he held to it even though the convention went on to nominate the man he least wanted, Estes Kefauver. He really preferred Kennedy or Humphrey, but he steadfastly refused to intervene in the convention's proceedings on this subject. Since that 56 convention, we've had 7 presidents, and 2 of the 7 were selected by that higher will, one by assassination and the other by resignation. That makes 9 out of 41, nearly one-fourth of our presidents. So the issue really transcends whatever your feelings may be about vice presidents quail or my own disposition toward puns. Stevenson not only called attention to the issue, but he pointed in the direction of a solution when he said that a vice presidential candidate should join the presidential candidate, as he said, before the nation, not as one man's selection, but as one chosen by our party, as I have been chosen. Now, since 56, we've had many changes in the method of choosing presidential candidates, but we've paid virtually no attention whatever to the selection process for the vice presidential candidates. In the early days of the nation, of course, we made the runner-up the president and the vice president. And that gave us Jefferson and Adams. And the contrast with the subsequent vice presidents is that have been chosen in our present careless fashion is more than painful. It's downright dangerous. So it's really welcome news, as I learned from Ken this morning, that you've been giving consideration of this question here at the Miller Center. The consequences of the changes in the nominating and election processes of recent years really have been abysmal, and it's important for us to recognize it. The changes we've made have not enhanced the democratic process as we intended them. The democratic process has been diminished. The record is clear. The present system is standing in the way of an effective expression of the political will, and what needs to be done should engage us as one of our highest priorities. A report on the nominating process by the Center here in 1982 carried forward warnings that Stevenson had stated bluntly in 56. State-by-state primaries, he said, made presidential candidates act as if they were running for county sheriff. Political commercials on television, he said, were turning the White House into a box of cornflakes. And the cost of political campaigns, he said, was turning candidates into whores. Today, the election seems increasingly to be accepting all those images. The 56 election was the first one in which state primaries became a significant element in presidential nominations. We forget that this is the state-by-state primary is such a recent invention. And even then, it was prevalent in only 19 states. And even then, Stevenson warned that the candidate was being pushed into dealing with issues of local concern, whether or not they had anything to do with any issue he might confront as president. And he cited an experience in Florida to illustrate his feelings that he was being pushed into running for county sheriff. War was about to break out in the Middle East, and in fact did break out shortly thereafter. And he was told that in Florida, he should talk about the Mediterranean fruit fly and catwalks on bridges where people could fish. And he told his advisors, "The world is in too much trouble to talk about catwalks and fruit flies. I'm going to talk about the international situation." But the people down here don't want to hear about the international situation, he was told. Then, he said, "I have an obligation to tell them." And he did. The next day, his opponent in the primary, Estes Kefauver, came to Florida, and what did he talk about? Catwalks and fruit flies. But Adley did carry the state, but by only 19,000 votes. In our last election, both candidates seemed to run either for county sheriff or for sanitation commissioner. It was sometimes hard to tell which. But worst of all, the present primary process stretches the selection process to a time span of at least 2 years. This extended time commitment produces boring candidates and, what's worse, a bored electorate. James McGregor Burns, in his recent book, The Crosswinds of Freedom, concludes that the presidential primary system, as he said, has choked off the recruitment of some of our best and busiest leaders. No responsible official, no business executive, no university president, no one with any administrative responsibilities, indeed few with any kind of an active life, can afford to neglect all else for so long. Now, vice presidents probably are an exception. But Massachusetts offers perhaps a more cogent example. Yet that state will suffer for years because of Governor Dukakis's neglect of the office he had during the 2 years of his long pursuit for the one he wanted. So the central fact is that many of our ablest, most trustworthy people are unwilling or unable to forsake their responsibilities for the demands of a 2-year state-by-state campaign. And Burns's conclusion is that we now have, and these are his words, one of the worst leadership recruitment systems in the Western world. Now, I'm not convinced we have to return to that smoke-filled hotel room of the political power brokers to find our answer. Democratic procedures don't need to be thrown overboard, but urgent consideration does need to be given to such alternatives as regional primaries or even a national primary within a limited time span. And the most pernicious aspect of this stretched out system is the truly obscene increase in the cost of political campaigns. Even in 1956, Stevenson warned of the consequences of the rising costs of campaigns. The resulting pressures, as he put it, to court fat cats and appeal to special interests were turning candidates, as I said in his language, into whores. And he used this strong language when the budget for his 1956 campaign was $1 million for the primaries and $4 million for the fall election. In the last election, the ceiling for the primaries was 27 times that. And we will never know how much over the ceiling expenditures actually went. Federal grants didn't exist in 1956, but in 1988, federal grants alone amounted to $46 million for each candidate, plus another $8.3 million for the national committees. Now, this $108.6 million was only the starting point for the impetus for raising even larger amounts of money from individuals, from corporations, from financial institutions such as, for example, of course, savings and loan banks, political action committees, and a vast array of special interests. Now, in the face of such financial pressures, it is difficult to believe that any candidate can emerge from an election free of obligations to special interests. And no wonder the public is cynical. And these pressures aren't restricted to presidential candidates. A recent congressional study revealed that the average senator, mind you, the average, must raise $1,800 in contributions every day of his 6 years in office for his re-election campaign. Beggars can't be choosers. And it's never easy, I'm told at least, to escape from the attitudes and habits of active prostitution, even when they're imposed by external circumstances. But external circumstances that inexorably push otherwise honorable people toward becoming either supplicants or prostitutes should and can be changed. Because people sense the implications of this obscene spending, and it is, I believe, a major reason for what President O'Neill's panel found, in its words, to be an astonishing indifference to election. When money decides, why vote? It's as simple as that. Now, those of us who are not indifferent are getting, the evidence is clear, we're getting increasingly angry. And Congress is reacting with a flurry of so-called campaign reform proposals. But all of them essentially are band-aids or fingers in the dike, and as in the case of the Fan Dancer, no one really expects any significant action. Senator Hollings and Danforth, for example, have proposed that any candidate who runs a television ad mentioning his opponent must do so in person and on camera. If candidates want to sling mud, Danforth says the voters should see their dirty hands. Another useful but hardly central idea is that any candidate receiving public funds would be required to agree to a minimum of 4 television debates. You know, we forget that the 1952 campaign was a first in which political commercials appeared on television. And as I mentioned earlier, Stevenson's reaction when he heard about the Republican plans was, what the hell do they think the White House is, a box of cornflakes? But by 1956, he was using them too. But his revulsion at this use or misuse of, I think we should admit, is humanity's most powerful instrument of communication, was reflected in his pioneering advocacy of presidential television debates. In the 1956 campaign, he was a victim of the so-called equal time provisions of the Federal Communications Act. And after the election, he joined with Senator Mike Monroney to amend the act. And that effort was only partially successful, but it led directly to the Nixon-Kennedy debates of 1960, which in the event probably swung the election to Kennedy. But the proposal Adlai placed before the Senate committee envisioned something quite different than we've had then, and certainly as a far cry from what the travesties that have been inflicted on us since. He proposed that beginning after Election Day, beginning after Labor Day, and continuing until Election Day, that at least one of the networks would be required to set aside 90 minutes of prime time every Monday night for a discussion of just one issue each night. Each candidate would have half an hour to outline his thinking on that one issue, and then each would have 15 minutes for rebuttal. And in that way, he felt people would have a full view of the candidate's thinking on major issues in the campaign. Now, he probably overrated the voters' attention span, but now even the chairman of the Republican National Committee is advocating 5 minutes a night for at least 6 weeks of a campaign, and that would move us at least from seconds to minutes and from sound bites to a modest chew. Hidden in the experience with television debates is the establishment of a very important precedent, indeed a basic principle, that hardly anyone dares to talk about. The time that has been given for the debates is truly a little bit of pregnancy, and it could produce a powerful offspring. Waiting to be born is the idea of a broad allocation of free time for political campaigns. Now, the holders of radio and television franchises like to have us forget that they are making their fortunes using airwaves that belong not to them, but to us. Their power and their vested interests are so huge that no political figure I know of has dared to make the radical suggestion that the franchise government gives the broadcasters should be dependent upon cost-free participation in the central function of government, which is the election of its leaders. Efforts to limit campaign spending, to restrict contributions by individuals, corporations, PACs, or whatever, are really doomed to failure. Ways around limitations will always be found. The basic problem is cost. And in this era of modern communication, that means television. Roughly half of the cost of both congressional and presidential campaigns now goes to pay for advertising on television. In one stroke, the costs of campaigns can be cut in half by applying a clear and very simple principle. Allocated free time must be a condition of a station's broadcast license, and it must be the only TV time allowed outside of debates and bona fide newscasts. Now, if that sounds radical to you, just ponder the fact that it was first proposed in relation to radio by one of Mr. Theobald's fellow Illinoisans, Frank Knox. He was, as you know, a Republican publisher and broadcaster who was Al Flanden's running mate in 1936. Then last year, the idea was more fully developed in a New York Times op-ed article by Max Kampelman, who was President Reagan's chief arms negotiator. The premise for such action is already established in our laws, in the concept that licenses to broadcast are granted, as the legislation states, in the public interest, convenience, and necessity. In a democracy, I contend, there is no greater public interest, convenience, and necessity than fair elections and an informed electorate. The television industry now seeks to kill the idea with silence. But if necessary, it will scream, because the stakes are high on both sides. We don't really know how many millions the television industry reaped from the 88 elections. It is estimated that the congressional elections alone yielded some $200 million. And loss of revenue of this magnitude certainly would not be accepted without a terrific battle. But weighed against total TV revenues in 1988 of nearly $27 billion, the loss would seem like a reasonable cost of doing business in a healthy democracy. Moreover, it really seems ridiculous for us to appropriate millions of dollars to buy time on airwaves that belong to us. At the outset, it might be wise to reduce the area of conflict by focusing only on presidential elections, because allocating free time in a congressional campaign when a station covers a number of districts does present more complications than a national election does. But before becoming defensive about the basic idea, it really is important to recognize that ours is the only democracy in which political candidates depend so heavily on paid television advertising. A recent UN study revealed that only Norway and Sri Lanka do not provide free airtime to their political candidates, and that's only because they allow no political advertising at all on their television. Canada, Japan, and Australia are the only other countries in which paid political advertising is allowed. What we have allowed, and with all the vested interests that have grown in consequence, certainly won't be easy to change. So far as I know, only two of the scores of bills that are now before the Congress even touch on this concept, but I don't think any of them confront it directly and develop its full implications. And there really is no good reason why the taxpayer should continue to pay in high ransom for the means of communication that belongs to all the people. Much of the maneuvering now going on in the Senate over campaign reform really resembles a continuing chess game aimed at protecting personal and party advantage. And sadly, that motivation is not so different from that that directed most of the changes in recent years. Generally, they've emerged from hasty, self-serving actions in national party conventions, or through actions by state legislatures that are more aimed at tourism and publicity than at choosing a candidate. And we must have something better than this hapless, almost mindless mosaic in which pattern often has very little relationship to purpose. I don't think a piecemeal approach will do. Virtually every change has some impact on some other part of the process. The range of issues is immense, and the opportunities for controversy are boundless, but really ways must be found. You know, many, many times in the face of far-reaching and difficult issues, we've turned to our major foundations for study, analysis, and recommendation. In this case, I'm inclined to think that the issues and the potential controversies make it difficult for any one foundation with the courage and resources to tackle the problem whole as it should be tackled. But isn't it possible, perhaps, that a consortium of foundations might have the vision to join together to create and finance a blue ribbon panel, a national commission on election reform? It would take time and money, prestige, and most of all, courage and clout. But the formation of a consortium by itself would underscore the central importance of the issues. The stakes are so high, I think that it's not unreasonable to hope for some such innovative approach to strengthening this strained fabric of our democracy. Now, Stevenson partisans, like so many of you, I think, lament the elections of 52 and 56. I don't. I think the opportunity to choose between an Eisenhower and a Stevenson was a high point in our political history. And ideas developed in those campaigns, as Mr. Miller knows so well, continue to shape our lives today. One thing I do lament, and that is the widely held conclusion drawn from his defeats, that intellect and ideals are a prescription for political failure. I think that's not only completely erroneous, but it's also dangerously cynical. It overlooks, to begin with, the fact that Eisenhower was a national hero of dimensions not exceeded, I don't think, since George Washington. No one living could have defeated him. And the lesson is not to be drawn from the fact that he lost, but it should be drawn from the fact that he did so well. It was his intellect, his ideals, and his eloquence that made him a viable candidate. They were what won him the governorship in Illinois over the exertions of a strong and corrupt machine. They were what brought him to national attention. They were what made him, as a defeated candidate, as much of an influence on our lives today as Eisenhower's policies as president did. So it's high time for us to reject the fantasy that ideas and ideals can't win and recognize these qualities as essential characteristics for those we choose as our leaders. During this 52 campaign, I had pasted by my word processor a quote of Adlai saying, "No intellectually dishonest candidate can, by the alchemy of election, become an honest president." The major lesson, though, that I took away from working on a Stevenson biography was that good ideas do have a life of their own, and that good candidates strengthen the fabric of our society whether or not they win. When he advocated federal aid to education, it was regarded as heresy. Proposals in the field of health care that were derided as fanciful in 56 became Medicare in the 60s. The end of the military draft, for which he was harshly ridiculed, was enacted and signed into law by the very people who had ridiculed him for proposing it. His advocacy of the nuclear test ban treaty that helped to defeat him in 56, he had the satisfaction of seeing signed into a treaty in Moscow in the 60s. Some of his speeches on the environment in 56 could be illuminating today. Many other examples could be cited, but Teddy White, I think, most eloquently made the point when he wrote at the time of Stevenson's death, "A generation of younger Americans brought up to feel that politics were dirty or sordid or corrupt or boss manipulated, learned from him that American politics were the mirror of American life and could be made to reflect the best in that life as well as the worst. His call brought thousands of new men into arenas they had hitherto despised or feared. He brought to the dialogue of American politics a quality of ideas, of thinking, of excitement, as if somehow one could have a reasonable discourse with people about the future. No man left a larger legacy." Now, I think that paragraph is more than a tribute to Adlai Stevenson. It's a declaration of the importance of political dialogue and the central role of our election process. So let me close with just a brief borrowing from that 1960 speech that he made at your Founders Day here at the University of Virginia, because I think it applies with awesome force to our contemporary experience. He said, "Political action alternates endlessly between the great poles of attitude that determine policy. Periods of high purpose and endeavor yield to periods of complacency and relaxation. Eras of energy and innovation are supplanted by eras of static timidity. Stages of high public virtue are succeeded by stages of moral confusion. Long years of struggle over mountainous terrain are followed by years of slumber in green valleys. We are emerging, we must emerge from one of these valleys today, and we must emerge with leaders who will have the courage to tell us the truth, the heart to inspire us, and the energy and the wisdom to show us the way." I will only add that election reform is a necessary first step up that hill. Thank you for listening to Stevenson and to me.
Henry, one idea you didn't, or one situation you didn't touch on is It seems to me it is the heart of the problem and also part of the great difficulty of changing things, and that is the importance of single-issue politics, which it's very difficult to see how that can be handled by legislation that it's a killer.
I think you're absolutely right, but I think that television lends itself to the development of single-issue politics. It enables the skilled manipulator of the instruments to dramatize those issues and push them center stage. That it wouldn't be the answer to the problem. I think voter sophistication is going to be part of it, but we have become accustomed to responding to emotional appeals, not to intellectual appeals, because of the reliance on sound bites and quick.
Well, also you have the First Amendment factor in there, which is a problem.
That will always be brought up, but I think it is possible to find formula that make it possible for everyone to get their right to speak in a fair way without without running counter to the First Amendment. It's rightfully should be in the background all the time, and maybe more than in the background, because it's a major protection for us, but we mustn't let it be used as the excuse for inaction. That's what the broadcast industry will plead.
Do you think the era...
Can you hear the questions out there?
Do you think the era going back, let's just say 70 years over that span, of much stronger major party control and domination of the selection of candidates produced better, more able candidates, or the other way?
My own sense is that the weaknesses of the national parties is a very serious problem. We do need, I think, strong political organization. But I think, again, one of the reasons for their decline has been the ability to reach the voters directly through television and radio and not rely on the party mechanism. And the parties, I think, are last beginning to wake up to the need for adapt their own machinery and mechanism to the demands of our new instruments of communication. How they're going to do it, I think, is a question needs to be watched very carefully the next few years. But strong political parties, I think, are an important part of our political process. And they have become weakened.
Next question.
Yes.
Wilson Newman.
I've learned to duck when he asked a question.
Last week, Senator Howard Baker, in a discussion of this subject with Ken Thompson, expressed in an offhand way, lightly but with serious import, that the process was flawed for many of the reasons that you have stated. He suggested a possible remedy being that we do not have an office of vice president, that we have only that in filling the office of vice president, I should say, that it be nominated by the president and endorsed by each of the houses. Would you react to that? And also the possibility, is there any other elective office where people are elected to do a job that they may not be called upon to perform for 4 years?
I think this is the most potent reason why it's hard to find people who are willing to take the job. The efforts to find a function for vice presidents have never yielded much result, and as long as I think he, as the vice president, is the selected assistant, in a sense, to the president, and chosen for reasons other than his ability to function as an effective public servant, for basically political or balance reasons, the job is going to be hard to fill with competent people. I hadn't heard the idea of having him elected by the two houses of the Congress. That's a very interesting one to pursue, I think. I hope you take on this study, because these ideas really need to be explored with great care, because we must do something better than what we have. But this sounds like a very good one to pursue.
Victor Yonke.
Mr. McKeever, if you did have the House elect the president, the vice president, rather, and you had a Congress that was in the opposite political plans, that would really weaken the presidency, wouldn't it?
It would. This is why I think it takes some careful study by...
Well, unless it was subject to the president's nomination.
That could be. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
President nominates, and then after the election of the president, as with in the method used with Rockefeller and with Ford, the both houses confirm, in effect, the choice.
And they could block it.
Well, it could embarrass that's the argument against. It could embarrass a president if they oppose his nomination.
But the interesting thing is we've never discussed alternatives like these in any serious forum that I know for decades. And to make it a matter of important public concern and subject to examination is I think, an important step forward that we desperately need to take, and I sure hope you pursue it here.
What do you think of James Reston's idea that the parties at least be given the right to say no to the choice of the nominee? In other words, if the nominee chooses a candidate for vice president, the parties, the party, at least the leadership of the party, approve. And if the president resists that approval, you have a fight on the floor of the convention. That's the sanction.
Yeah, wouldn't it be hard, though, in practical matter to make that meaningful? A convention normally is caught up in the euphoria of the presidential candidate, and the tendency to deny him his choice is hard to bring to the fore.
Be easier. Have you seen John Chancellor's new book?
I haven't seen it.
The argument there is that we ought to restore the convention to its deliberative function and have discussions and debates and really do what Chancellor said we did much better in choosing candidates when the convention did play a role, but not with 3,000 to 5,000 people at the convention.
Well, it's strange. Adlai III, when he was confronted with these far-right candidates in Illinois when he was running for governor, one had to look at the irony of it. If there were political bosses in place in Illinois, they would not have allowed these guys to get on the ticket. But the weak party mechanism in Illinois was looking the other way. And so he got stuck with a lieutenant governor and what was an attorney general that he refused to run with. A political boss would never have let that happen.
Other questions? Yeah, Matthew Holden. You want to come forward so we can hear and hear
more? I suspect I can be heard. Is it possible, Mr. Shiva, to make the case that while the financial issue you raised is very important, that we are in these secondly, the year 1920 was mentioned when someone said, if you take 70 years ago as a baseline, I point out that the candidates nominated in 1920 were Governor James Cox, who with Franklin Delano Roosevelt, a then much unfired figure as a vice presidential candidate, and the other distinguished candidates were Warren G. Harding and Calvin Coolidge. That in 1924, the Democratic National Convention struggled for 3 weeks to get a candidate. And that the kind of discussion we've had is the discussion we've had for a very long time in American history. And I wonder whether we are arguably a little bit over intense about it. That's too long a question, but.
Well, it would be difficult for me to concede that we're overly intense upon the selection of a president of the United States who, at this point in man's history, holds so much of the fate of the world in his hands. It is a choice of almost paramount importance. And when it's made by barely half of the electorate, clearly something is wrong and needs to be changed. I wouldn't want to argue in defense of the selection process in the past. There are many, many things that went wrong during that period, but I think what we're talking about here is how the electorate decides as between the candidates they're presented with. And I think the advent of mass communications has quite altered the whole process by which the electorate makes decisions and decides whether or not to participate. And we, I think, are faced with a whole new set of circumstances, as well as a new level of importance for the job that really requires us to give the utmost thought to how we go about it, recognizing that we haven't done too well in the past, to be sure, but that we do have to learn from that past and move on to meeting the challenges that face us and faces the president now.
You want to, the other Stevenson man in the room is Bill Miller. Do you want to ask him?
Well, I provoke so many thoughts. Makes me proud again to have been a part of that 56 campaign. I usually speak humbly and say it wasn't the 52 campaign, which is the one everyone remembers, but the 56 campaign. Mr. McKeever makes me think, well, that wasn't such a bad campaign after all, the second Stevenson campaign. I wonder if Stevenson, the point we've been talking about, there was a kind of a remarkable moment there when, so far as the choice the American people had, better, let's generalize swiftly, better both in the ones that Matthew Holden has mentioned, the 1920s and later, and better than later. That is, just thinking of it as looking at what did the American people get. And didn't television play in its then state? The mixture was about right. Political boss Jay Garvey had a considerable role, and L.A. Stevenson even being there for us to pick him.
Who's
in Illinois, and he needed some lost leaders, but some glamour leaders for and Paul Douglas and L.A. Stevenson were people whom an old-fashioned boss came up with to some extent. On the other hand, Stevenson would never have had the support of a lot of us people like you and me. Didn't know who this man was until we began to get the mass communication vibrations. I mean, the moment when we did stay up and hear L.A. Stevenson give his acceptance speech in 1952, extraordinary speech, on television, radio too, was a moment when a lot of when the Stevenson, the larger Madley for Adley's group was formed. So that mass communication and old-fashioned politics meshed in a good way in the 52 and 56 elections to produce these two candidates. Eisenhower might have been nominated at any time, although plenty of the Republican professional politicians, they wanted Taft. Eisenhower was an outsider.
Yeah.
And it was partly the state of the then publicity that helped the Eisenhower people to defeat the Taft people. Now, how do you go about reconstructing a time when the ingredients of what Don Sears was talking about here in the public of the value of having people to really know the candidates and know what politics is about, know what government is about. These people denigrated as bosses, they play an important role. But how you mix that, they'll produce some other things we don't want. Mix that in the right way with communication. How to do that, you've been talking all about. But that, we had a period there for a moment when it worked well, yeah. is one of the many impressions I have from here, too.
Well, you know, in 52, Stevenson didn't have a television set in the governor's mansion. He didn't own a television set. And when he wanted to watch some baseball games, he would go to a friend's house and watch it on television. And he was always very uncomfortable with television. When he was speaking at a rostrum at a rally, he managed to ignore the existence of it, but he was always terribly uncomfortable and didn't know how to use television.
He left the tail end of his speech at Harrisburg out in darkness. He never got it in.
Well, I know in his final fireside chat in 52, he ran overtime, and Lou Cowan and a couple of us went up and down the aisles of the Blackstone Theater raising $7,000 while Eisenhower was speaking so he could get the tail end of Adlai's speech broadcast in Los Angeles, Boston, Detroit, and New York. $7,000, we thought it a fantastic sum. Now that wouldn't buy you 10 seconds. Television, I think, really has brought a basic change in the way in which we make up our minds about our candidates. And I don't think we've sat back and really given serious thought to how you mesh that into our political process. I think it's contributed to a line that Adlai said after 56 when he said, the problem of a political campaign is how to win without proving you're unworthy of winning. And I think television encourages us to be unworthy of winning.
Any final questions? Matt Albert?
After the 52 defeat, Mr. Stevenson, one would have thought that he would have been somewhat discouraged against running against such a popular individual as Eisenhower. How realistic was he in assessing his chances for the 56 election? And if he was unrealistic and thought he had a pretty good chance, what was the impact of the second defeat psychologically on him?
I don't think he thought he could win 56. Well, I go back to 50. In 52, he really thought Eisenhower was a very desirable candidate, and he got involved the hope that he could be part of defeating Taft. He too thought it was time for a change in 52, and it was only as a campaign, and he was quite reluctant. There's one of the elements in his reluctance in 52, but as the campaign went on, he was so appalled by the campaign that Eisenhower mounted that he got a certain amount of zeal into his campaign, and that mounted throughout the next 4 years. His disillusionment, I think, with the Eisenhower policies, particularly in the field of foreign affairs, but also in the lack of leadership in connection with McCarthyism and civil rights. He felt deeply about. So that 56, when 56 came around, he didn't think he had much of a chance of winning, but he thought the issues were so important and he had people who would listen to him that he thought it was worth using the bully pulpit of the campaign to advance ideas. And that's where I think the research and the policy papers that went into that campaign were so important and became such an influence later, but he saw that whole 56 campaign as a very unlikely opportunity for election, but an excellent opportunity for illuminating issues. The psychological impact was profound because he didn't anticipate he'd be licked so overwhelmingly. He was licked far worse in 56 and then 52, but I think that was largely because war Hungarian incident exploded, Eastern Europe exploded, and also the Middle Eastern War began. So quite naturally, I think the American public turned to the military hero to respond to the events which our foreign policy had helped create. But nonetheless, people wanted the security, I think, at that point, of a strong military leader in the White House.
So he was pretty depressed?
He was it was a very devastating blow to him, yeah.
Any other questions? In our oral history, Porter, we always ask the question of what were the weaknesses as well as the strengths of the candidate? And Walter Johnson makes the point in his biography, as you know, that there is something to this argument that Stevenson was indecisive. And yet, at the prison riots, he was anything but indecisive, and you always counter that argument with that answer. But what were his weaknesses?
Well, it's an interesting dichotomy. I haven't been able to sort this out completely myself. It's absolutely clear he was utterly indecisive on things relating to himself. Should he himself do something? As Carl McGowan said, he'd have a hard time deciding whether to play tennis at 4 or 5. But when it came to an issue outside of himself, a public policy issue, no one who was close to him ever suggested for a second that he was indecisive. A lot of the things that I think created that impression had gone into his capacity as a lawyer to think out loud. I happen to think the largest problem was that he didn't have a wife that he could engage in pillow talk with and talk out some of these things. So he talked it out, and these indecisive things, these things, processes of making a decision, he talked them out in public while he was thinking them through. Most of us would do it at home at night with our wives. He didn't have that. The perception became an important weakness, and that was a major weakness, I think, in the perception of him. I think a major weakness was his sense that language and ideas was all you needed to do. He would neglect seriously political contact work. He would sit in his compartment writing on a speech when all of the major POWs of that particular state were cooling their heels outside. And this led him also to being accused, and I think understandably so, of insensitivity to some of the civil rights leaders. Same thing you have in San Francisco, most notably, when the state was very close. The top black leaders of California waited for him for an hour while he was working on a speech, and he worked on the speech till it was just broadcast time, and he rushed out and went past them. He shouldn't have been insensitive to those kinds of things. And they were understandably very offended, and he almost lost California because he was not sensitive to those things. The ideas and the words were far too important to him to be, I think, an effective political operator. I liked him so much, it's hard for me to find many shortcomings past that. There was an element of snobism in that way, too. Social snobism, which always put me off a little bit, and I don't know whether it would have manifested itself. And again, it was one of those strange dichotomies. It happened in his personal life, but in his intellectual, philosophical life, he was egalitarian as any human being could be, and it was often hard to reconcile his desire to spend his time with very rich, very elite, usually married ladies, with this egalitarian instinct that he undeniably had. Some of the ladies I wanted to interview were still alive, wouldn't see me because they're still angry at the fact that they felt that he jilted them.
Any final question? Well, a very rewarding experience to listen to a discussion like this, not least because the words are spoken with passion. And maybe that's...
That's just the Irish in me.
maybe that's another ingredient of politics that ought to be reinstituted and time to time, and people actually talking as though they mean it. In any case, this certainly is a memorable discussion, and I think all of us want even more, I'm sure, to read the book now that our appetites are whetted. Thank you very much.
Morrow will kill me, but it's coming out in paperback this winter, and I would wait for the edition that's only half as expensive as a $25 book, which I think is obscene to charge.
Well, we thank you very much.